for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. New York Times columnist David Brooks is out with a new book he says he wrote to save his own soul. He says our selfie culture, which he acknowledges he is part of, has gone too far. The obsession with individual achievement, success, and promotion has eclipsed deeper, more important values like humility and service to others. The title of his book is The Road to Character. And David Brooks joins me in the studio. You're welcome, as always, to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. David Brooks, it's good to see you again.
It's so good to be with you again, Dan.
Thank you. David, explain what you mean when you said you wrote this book to save your own soul.
Well, you achieve certain things in your career. I've achieved far more than I ever thought I would growing up. And you find the elemental truth, which everybody should know in high school, that career success doesn't lead to fulfillment or happiness. And so that's one thing. And then the second thing is you have certain experiences, and you meet certain people, people who just radiate joy and radiate an inner life. And I've known such people, and I'm sure you have, through your life. And I had a friend named Wes when I was a camp counselor who was a basketball coach. I have a friend named Ray who was down here in Anacostia. I ran into some women in Frederick, Maryland who teach immigrants how to read. And I walk into the room with them, and they just radiated patience and goodness and calmness, and they made you feel so valuable even to be in their presence. And so I wasn't in some sort of crisis, but I said, you know, those people who have that inner joy, they have something I don't have. I'd like to have that, or I'd like to at least approach that. And so I wanted to figure out, how do people get that? And I know I don't have it, and I know I'm not always present for people. I'm can be hard-hearted and shallow, but I wanted to at least try to move in that direction.
But, you know, moving in that direction, as you wrote about people who've written about what character is, what the soul is, what joy is, what did you learn about yourself?
Well, I learned two things. I think one of the things, all the people in my book, it was really a series of moral essays, but as profiles. And so all of them have one thing in common. They were really unimpressive at 20, but they were really magnificent at 70. And they built themselves into something truly great. And there are people like Francis Perkins, who was Secretary of Labor, Dorothy Day, Dwight Eisenhower, George Marshall, even going back to history to Samuel Johnson and Augustine and Bayard Rustin, a great civil rights activist. And what they had in common was the ability to understand their own weakness and to transcend it sometimes over a lifetime. And so I guess I learned two things about myself. I think it's important to sit down in life and say, what's my greatest sin from which all the others flow? And everyone has different one. My characters, Bayard Rustin, it was egotism early on. Francis Perkins was sort of disorganized. Dorothy Day was just emotionally needy, like George Eliot, another character. For mine, used to think it was shallowness, and I still suffer from that. But I also concluded also it's the need to be loved. And you got to sort of fill that. And so I learned that about myself, and now I try to think, can I do better every day? And then the second thing I learned, which I did not know, is that I used to think character was like this iron figure of willpower inside. And that's like the Victorian definition of character, sort of rigid. And then I realized none of us is strong enough to defeat our self-deceptions and our selfishness and our self-centeredness on our own. We all need redemptive assistance from outside. We all need friends. We all need convictions. And so I say at one point in the book that a person with character has a commitment about fundamental truths, a philosophy of life, that they're committed to certain ideas. In the realm of love, they're surrounded by and enmeshed in a web of unconditional loves. In the realm of action, they're committed to a cause that can't be completed in a lifetime. And so the people I wrote about are capable of awesome commitment. They're capable of really strong commitments to a cause, to a person, to a vocation.
Now, I am not surprising you by saying this, because it was in the newspaper that you recently, after a long marriage, got divorced.
Right.
So that idea of commitment for right. you had to have been shattered somewhere right. along
yeah.
the way.
And I don't talk about that in my private life, but I do. You know, we all go through things in life. And all of us
you
have
bet.
Gone through moments of joy and moments of pain. And I think one of the things you try to learn from is how to take, say, the moments of suffering and turn them into something good. And in my book, a character named Samuel Johnson had really a wretched early childhood, and he suffered. But he turned his suffering into radical self-awareness and honesty. I quote in the book a theologian named Paul Tillich, who was around in the 1950s or so, and he said what suffering does is it interrupts the daily reality of life and reminds you you're not who you thought you were. And he said what suffering does, it digs into the cavity at what you thought was the basement of your soul and digs through the floor and reveals a cavity below, reveals a cavity below, and reveals a cavity below. So suffering can create great self-awareness. And I don't glorify suffering. I don't think anybody should volunteer to go into it. But if you live a long life, suffering will come. And you can turn it into really a better self-understanding.
Now, do you recall when the whole awareness of the term self-esteem came yeah. into being and how we began teaching children that self-esteem was so important? I find myself wondering whether the use of that term has translated into somehow an inflated feeling of self-importance today.
Yeah, I think it has, and I think there's some data to suggest it has. Some of the statistics I quote in the book is in 1950, the Gallup Organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? In 1950, 12% said yes. They asked the same question in 2005, and it wasn't 12%, it was 80% who said yes. They have a thing called narcissism tests where they ask people a bunch of statements and they say, does this apply to you? And there are statements like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so extraordinary. Somebody should write a biography
wow.
about me. And the number of people who say that those statements apply to them has risen 30% in the last 20 years.
Wow.
And so we've become a more self-confident culture. We've become a culture much more interested in fame. Becoming famous was not an important value for most college freshmen 30 or 40 years ago. Now it's usually second or third after financial security. People really want to be famous. And then the third thing that's happened, if you look at our language, it's changed. We've become a much more economically minded culture and a much less morally minded culture. So there are these things, Google engrams, where you can go through Google, do these massive searches about what words are used in all the books and all the magazines and newspapers any given day. And over the last 50 years, the amount of economic words have risen in usage, whereas moral words have declined radically. So the word courage is down like 50%. The word humility is down 50%. The word virtue or honor or kindness is down 50 or 60%. And so you see people's minds shift toward a more economic way of thinking and a less moral way of thinking. And I think that has to do with some loss of humility, I'd say.
Where do you think that loss of humility and the desire for fame yeah. are coming from? I mean, you think about the Kardashians yeah. on television. You think about the game shows on television where people are competing and running and choosing, and beauty becomes so important. I mean, has that affected the way our culture is evolving?
I think so. I should preface it by saying I don't want to seem like I'm nostalgic for the past, because none of us would want to go back to the culture of the 1940s or the 1950s, because it was a more racist culture, more sexist culture, a more emotionally cold culture. Fathers in particular had a great deal of trouble expressing their emotion to their kids and to others. It's just a more boring culture. The food was more boring, everything. But I do think in one respect they had some advantages or somewhat awareness that we could use, not to adopt, but to modernize. And that's a definition of self. I do think there was a culture of self-effacement. I'm no better than anybody else, but nobody's better than me. And there was a little more social price put against people who were too big for their britches, who were like boasting. And I think that went away partly with humanistic psychology, partly with the self-esteem movement in the 70s. And so it just became tolerable to boast about yourself all the time, to talk more about yourself. and not to really think, well, what are my problems here? And how do I challenge those problems? And that had some good effects. I mean, the great effects were that we had many groups in the society who had been taught over the centuries to think too lowly of themselves, women, minorities, and they needed to be boosted up to a proper level of equality and aspiration. And so that was great. If you read, it's very useful to read Katharine Graham's memoir, which I referred to.
She
was someone who was raised not to think, not to realize her own capacities.
Talk about humility.
Right. But she came to realize her capacities while keeping the humility in the course of her life. She's a remarkable woman, a remarkable book. But I do think we've overshot the mark, and now we're a little too proud of ourselves sometimes, and as individuals, we could use a little humility.
David Brooks, his new book is titled The Road to Character. Do join us. 800-433-8850. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carbonite, providing secure backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has backed up more than 500 billion files, from email servers to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering weekend appointments to help patients maintain their weekday schedules and routines while undergoing treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. David Brooks, New York Times journalist, op-ed columnist, is with me. His new book is titled The Road to Character. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. You know, I think friendship is one of the ways we learn to be humble. If we truly give ourselves to a friendship, we learn from that friendship honesty, perhaps humility, confessions of wrong. Friendships are so important on the road to character.
I completely agree. In the book, I have a passage on Montaigne, the French writer, who had this magnificent friendship with a guy whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce, but it was a great friendship and was the core of his life. And he said, one of the things that friendship does, it decenters the self. You realize that your riches are not in yourself, they're in another. And another point he made was that it eliminates the distinction between giving and receiving. That when a friend gives a gift, he gets the greater pleasure because he gets to give the gift to his friend. And then he says, well, how was it friendship? How did the friendship arise? And he said, I couldn't tell you how the friendship arose. It was a million ways that my mind merged with his and his mind merged with mine. And when it came to a life decision, I would rather trust his judgment than my own judgment. It was just such a complexity. And finally he was asked, why? How did it come that way? And he just said it was because he was he and I was I.
Exactly. I can tell within 3 minutes of a conversation at a dinner party with the partner whether this person is going to be genuine or not. And that comes in part as to whether that person is willing to engage, not only to talk about him or herself, but to ask questions. Yeah. People who want to learn ask questions. People who are filled with their own self-esteem spend a whole dinner party talking about themselves.
Yes, now we've all been there, and maybe I've been guilty of being that myself. I would say there are three skills that leap to mind as you were saying. The first is the ability to ask questions. The second is the ability to listen, not just to pause between your own soliloquies. The third is the ability to actually perceive what they're not saying. And the fourth is the ability to be vulnerable enough to invite sharing, to set a context in which people could share. And that was something I was certainly terrible at through much of
really?
My life.
Give me an example.
I was just not someone who people confided in. I think I was just moving too fast, or I was radiating a fear of emotion. And hopefully I'm a little better now, and I have found more people have confided. I don't always know what to say. It's really a challenge to know what to say when somebody presents you with something that's very painful to them. You just try to be there and hug them, which is something I try to do, and not natural. But you just have to sit there and be present for them.
When I walked into the studio, you asked me how I was, and I said, oh, I'm okay. And you said, just okay.
Yeah.
What were you looking for?
Well, then in my mind, we've known each other for quite a while. And so my mind was thinking, does Diane have is there a health issue? Is it emotional? Maybe she didn't sleep. Of course, you run through the little Rolodex of things could be bothering you. And what can I do? I don't know.
I'm glad you said that. I was not feeling 100% today. I had kind of a rough time yesterday. But I think you're asking me that put me on notice that I wasn't up to snuff.
I had a great experience. This is not in the book, but I ran into a woman who had lost a daughter in Afghanistan, then another daughter had a bike accident, nearly was lost. And so she said, I said, how do you deal with people who are facing trauma? And one thing she said that was so useful to me was, people want to know, should they ask me about Anna, the one who was lost in Afghanistan? Because maybe they don't want to put me in a bad mood and remind me of her. And she said to me, you should always mention her, because Anna is never not on my mind. And that if you ask about her, you're giving me an excuse to talk about her if I want to, and not if I don't. And that was a very useful piece of advice. And then she gave me a bunch of other advice, how to be with people in trauma. Just sit there. Just show up. Just practice the art of presence. Don't compare. Don't say, oh, you're experiencing bad stuff, but I had my dog die. Don't ever make that comparison because it feels insulting. And so she gave me a whole litany of things that were so valuable for those of us who hope to someday be of comfort to people to learn.
That's lovely. Actually, you talk about having heard the program Command Performance on this station early on when you were starting to write this
book. It was really the seminal experience for the book. I was driving when I lived in Bethesda, we lived there, and on 88.5 here in Washington, WAMU plays a program called The Big Broadcast, where they rebroadcast old radio plays, and it's like Gunsmoke and Dragnet. There's one about a claims adjuster, I forget, Johnny Dollar. And I happened to hear a show called Command Performance, which was a variety show that went out to the troops in World War II. And I heard the episode broadcast on VJ Day, just as the Japanese announced their surrender. And Bing Crosby was the host, and he said, we've won this war, but I guess at this moment we don't feel too proud, we just feel humbled. And I was struck. And then I listened to the whole broadcast in the driveway, and Burgess Meredith, in the middle of the great character actor, gets out and reads a passage from Ernie Pyle, the war correspondent. And it said, we won this war because we're brave allies. We happen to have a lot of material abundance. We didn't win this because we're God's chosen people. We didn't win it because we're better than anybody else. We should just try to stay modest and be worthy of the peace. And it was such an act of a beautiful display of, hey, we're not beating our chests here. We're just humble. And then I go into my house and I turn on the TV and I watch a football game. and the quarterback throws a pass to a wide receiver, gets tackled after a two-yard gain, and the defensive player does what professional athletes do, a big self-puffing victory dance. And it occurred to me I'd seen more self-puffing victory after a two-yard gain than I'd heard after winning World War II.
Wow.
And that did begin to symbolize for me a shift in culture.
I'm sure Ed Walker, who hosts the big broadcast, will be very happy to know what a role he played in helping you begin your own thinking about this. I wonder also about the idea of wealth and the extent to which we have come to focus on it, to admire it, to even try to tear down people who have it, all those conflicting emotions.
Right. Yeah, well, the book is really built around a dualism between the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. And the resume virtues are the things you bring to the marketplace that make you money, whether you're good at your job or whatever. And the eulogy virtues are the things they say about you after you're dead, whether you're courageous, honorable, honest, capable of great love. And we all know that the eulogy virtues are more important. We'd all rather have those. But our school system and sometimes the way we raise our kids and maybe our broader culture focus a lot more on the resume virtues. And a lot of us are a lot more clear about how to build a great career than to have a good inner character. And so that distinction really was the core of the thing. And I wanted to find people who'd had great careers. And I'm not against having a great career and making money. God bless you if you can do that. But who had the balance. And so they had a great inner life as well. And so,
where do we find that, do you think, in today's contemporary life? Of whom can you think who perhaps personifies that kind of balance?
So among people who seem great at both ends, a person I know well, but who's also, I think, a great public service, is our UN ambassador, Samantha Power. I think very highly of her. A dear friend of both of ours is a man I worked for many years, Jim Lehrer. And he was someone who has had a great career, but I also exemplified just great dignity and great integrity. I told somebody the other night that on the air, Jim, for those of us who watch the NewsHour, he had pretty a stoical face. He didn't want to express because it was always about the story and not about him. But when you were talking to him on the air, he would express things. And when you said something self-aggrandizing or cheap, his little lips would turn down in displeasure. And if you said something he liked, his eyes would crinkle in a little happiness. And so for the 10 years that I was talking to him on the air, I was trying to avoid the downturned lips and trying to get the crinkle of the eye. And without ever saying anything to me, he was sort of a mentor in that way. He would, which way to go, which way not to go. And those little gestures were a mode of education for me. And so that's how our mentors really affect us, just by being a certain way, and then we try to be more like them. And those are certainly two people. There's a writer who I scarcely know, but who I think I admire from his reading and from his manner, which is a writer, Atul Gawande, who's a surgeon in Massachusetts.
He would certainly
fit into those categories. Yeah. And those are just the famous ones. We all know people who are great, but who don't happen to have a job that puts them in the public eye.
I think one of my great teachers, well, two of them, certainly my husband, who died last year. And when you were talking about my response to you being just okay, I think I go through waves of just feeling the loss. And sometimes it just hits me.
Right.
But my friend Jane Dixon, the former Bishop of Washington, who taught me so much about humility and love and the ability to give. I feel so fortunate to have had those people in my life. Let's open the phones, hear what our listeners have to say. First to Andrew in Cincinnati, Ohio. You're on the air.
Yes, I always grew up understanding self-esteem as something that had to be earned. And this, self-esteem consciousness you're talking about is clearly something which is merely delivered and, is not a factor of being earned. I think that, having real self-esteem depends on having moral courage.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, the best thing I ever did with my column in the New York Times was to ask my readers over 70 to send in what they called life reports, which was a little essays on how they'd done in life. And most people gave themselves A-minuses for their career, B-minuses for personal life. And you learn some things about life, that you should always take risks, that people over 70 were always glad for pretty much every risk they'd ever taken, whether it worked out or not. One guy said he tried to change his wife for 20 years and finally discovered you can't change other people.
Of course.
That's a good rule.
good learning.
And then some people said, a lot of people said, I divided my life into chapters. And at the beginning of every 5 years or every 7 years, I'd ask myself fundamental questions. Am I happy with my life? Am I happy with this? And the people who were unhappy, their lives just dribbled out day by day without moments to step back. But one of my big takeaways was that people get better at living. They figure stuff out. And as they get older, they get happier and just better at it. That's to me, is a hopeful lesson. And I think with self-esteem, I make the distinction between self-esteem and self-respect. That self-esteem might be better than other people, but self-respect is better than it used to be. It's something that's earned in that way.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Tampa, Florida. Hi there, Lorraine. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I find this topic really interesting because I have noticed for a long time in my lifetime how things have changed in our society and in our culture, where the values that I was brought up with seem so out of touch now. And what I call the Christian virtues of humility and selflessness and caring for others have been supplanted by the more superficial things like pleasure and fame and narcissism. And I was wondering, I haven't read your book yet, Mr. Brooks, but I was just wondering, do you think that these are things that contribute to the decline of a society? Do you think our society is in a decline right now?
Yeah, I wouldn't say overall decline. As I say, I think we're more fair than we used to be, more fair to people of different genders and different races. And we made moral progress even in domestic things. People are less angry with each other. There's less violence. Steven Pinker wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature. But I think every culture tries to deal with its own problems. And I think one of the problems we do have is a bit of pride, a bit of inflated sense of self. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because of the meritocracy. You're in a competitive world. You got to brand yourself. You're in social media. You know, you want to get all those likes and put a little highlight reel of yourself on Facebook. And so there's a lot of things encouraging people to be big about themselves, the culture of the big me. So I think that's, I'm not sure we're in overall decline, but it's something we can work on, certainly something I can work on. Look, I'm paid to be a columnist, so I'm certainly paid to, and I do broadcast myself out there. I'm in front of a microphone a lot. And each situation comes with its own character challenges that we can face up to and try to at least address.
But you know, either we read more about what's happening in our culture. I mean, I just think about that football player yesterday in Massachusetts, convicted of life in prison without parole for murder and about to be tried once again. And yet on the football field, a totally different character.
Right.
I think about the question of whether we have become a culture that simply accepts that all of this is going on instead of rising up against it.
Right.
We're not doing that.
Yeah, and I think what's necessary is to step out of the culture of self-aggrandizement and step into a counterculture. And really harken back to an older tradition, which in the book I call the tradition of the crooked timber, that we're all crooked timber, that we're all imperfect, and that we're splendidly endowed in some ways, but we're deeply broken in others. And I think there are ways to do that. As I said earlier, you can go home at night and write, what is my sin and how do I correct it? How did I do today? Was I there? Was I present for people? But I think the big thing is don't try to do it alone. This is something done with a discussion group. You can get together and talk about times in your life when you suffered and how did that work? How did love mean to you? What does second love mean to you? And that's the idea of that there's one love when you're first in the full flush of love, but then there's a second love when you're older, you're more settled, you've got some bruises and you're in the middle of long commitments. Have you transitioned from the first love to the second love? How do you do that? And so there are all these fundamental moral issues. I think we're a little out of the habit of just sitting down with groups of friends and having those conversations. And, you know, the book is going to be very imperfect, and it's only a book, but I hope that there could be a shift in conversation away from a lot of, you know, I talk about politics a lot. I love talking about politics, but we talk a little too much about politics and a little too little about morality. And if we could find a way to talk about morality without being self-righteous and preachy, that would be a wonderful thing.
Are you in such a group now?
I have groups of friends, and we do. Some we gather formally, and some this is just what we do. But it's a challenge.
David Brooks, his new book is titled The Road to Character. More of your calls, your comments. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. From Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
This hit single featuring Bruno Mars is from Mark Ronson's latest album. Ronson is a musician and producer. He produced the hit Amy Winehouse album Back to Black and has produced recordings with Adele, Paul McCartney, Lily Allen, Jimmy Fallon, and Ghostface Killah. Mark Ronson joins us on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. We've got interesting emails, many phone calls. Here's an email from Patsy, who says, thank you for this interesting and enlightening program. Having read Mr. Brooks' column in the New York Times for many years and rarely agreeing with him, I find the new David Brooks intriguing. Should we expect his opinions to change from conservative to a more liberal point of view? Will he continue to be a political pundit?
Well, I think the subjects in this book, or the subject of this book is deeper than politics, and some things are just deeper. Of the people I profile and who really are my heroes, some are quite far left. Dorothy Day was very progressive. Baird Rustin, Philip Randolph, Francis Perkins. Some are a little more on the conservative side. George Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower was a moderate Republican. George Eliot is very hard to place. She was both.
Yes.
But I do think there's just a world. One of Samuel Johnson's great couplets, I'm not going to get it quite right, is, of all the things that human hearts endure, how few are those that kings can cause or cure. And what he meant by that was a lot of the things that matter in our life, our relationships, our character, that's beneath politics. It's more fundamental and more foundational than politics. So this book is not meant to be too political. I don't know if it'll change my political views. I don't know.
Is there a new David Brooks?
I do think we have a responsibility to try to be better every day. So I wouldn't say I've radically changed. My friends still know me as me. But, I, you know, one tries to do a little better every day and get a little deeper, more profound. And I think, you know, you mentioned the things I've gone through in the last few years. You can't help but try to be better. And, you know, I'm nobody's example. I'm nobody's exemplar. But you can't help but go through things, in, even late in life. I'm 53, I'm in the middle of life, to think, you know, life is still filled with possibilities and openness.
You bet. You bet. Here's another email from Kimberly, who says she read about the study in the New York Times article about raising a moral child by Jean Hunt. Researchers found if parents tweak their language a bit when praising their children, they will build character. So instead of praising the action, like it was good that you finished your homework before playing on the computer, praise the character, like you finished your homework first, you are very responsible. This, in turn, helps children internalize the character as part of their identity and think, I am responsible. Then when they do something that is not responsible, it begins to violate their own value system.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I love for two reasons. One, it turns a small daily event into a moral occasion. You're thinking, oh, how does this affect me? And second, I think you're communicating to the child that there's a core piece of you inside yourself that makes decisions. And if you make great decisions, and then you'll turn that core piece into something strong. And if you make indisciplined decisions, you'll fragment that core piece. And so we're always sort of building ourselves with even the small decisions we make, even if nobody else is around.
And boy, I wish I could go back and do motherhood yeah, all over again.
Yeah.
I mean, you learn, as you've said, so much as you grow older. Mm-hmm. And having watched my daughter raise her children, my son raise his children, it just feels as though it's a different era of understanding and communication with children about how to become more moral characters in some ways.
I got an email. I'm sure one of the things you learn about if you read the studies on parenting is you just have to be good enough. You just have to be there, be affectionate, be unconditional, and just establish relationships. The other thing you learn is that I got an email from a guy, it's in the book, named Dave Jolly, who I've never met, and he said, never forget that what a wise person says is the least of that which they give. The message is in the totality of their actions, the small little things you do every day. And then he had a phrase I loved, never forget, the message is the person. It's how you act, it's not what you say. And so for parenting, that's certainly true.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Jared in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi there, Jared.
Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call and such a thought-provoking and wonderful beginning of a conversation. Mr. Brooks, I had a question that I'd like to raise regarding religions that we very seldomly speak about in public company. In America, there's been a decline of religion or those who associate themselves as religious. Has that played into, in the best of your knowledge, our character development?
I know people who are very faithful, who of any religion, who are wonderful, wonderful people and radiate that inner light I talked about. I know a lot of secular people who also do. I know both kinds. So I don't think it's necessary to have faith to be just an incredibly wonderful person. Many people find it deeply and fulfilling. But I do think that faith and the traditions of faith that have developed over the centuries have offered us vocabulary to think about these things. And there are words like grace or sin or redemption. And those are words, whether you are believe in God or not, just are very useful in thinking about the inner life and the moral life. And so there are people, the most famous is Abraham Lincoln. He was a guy, we're not really, it's people debate about how faithful he was. He was certainly not an Orthodox Christian by any means. I think he believed in an active God, but a hidden God. But he did, he grew up reading the King James Bible, and he knew the stories and he knew the categories, and that vocabulary really helped him think about things. And I do think it's having, you know, I'm not a religious writer, so I'm not going to tell you how to interpret sensations of the Almighty. But I will say that understanding those categories is a very useful way to have moral thoughts in your head.
Eric writes, Jimmy Carter appears to have good character, but he was not a very good president. Do you think character is important for leaders?
I certainly do. I believe if your character is really shattered, and we all have flaws, but if it's really shattered, then your Watergate will come. You won't be able to sustain a long public career without some scandal because you won't have some basic inner criteria. We all know people who are very successful who we would not say are particularly heroes. They can make a lot of money and they can have certain skills. But I do think there are some cases where you want to surround yourself and you want to elect people who have good character. I ran into a guy who hires people. That's his job. He hires people for a company. And one of the questions he asks is, name a time you told the truth and it hurt you. And he wanted to know if people were willing to put their character above professional success sometimes. And so I think it's complicated. Sometimes having good character, you see it in people, it helps their success because people want to work with them. They trust them.
How would you answer his question?
About the presidential candidates?
No, how you had to tell the truth and it hurt.
That's a good time. Some of it was just, some of my tough times and sleepless nights were more political about times I made mistakes and recommended the wrong thing and would lose friends over it. And
such as?
Well, the Iraq War is the famous one. And so I do remember sleepless nights. I had written the column. It was going to appear the next day. And when you do that, your friends don't like you. And the people who disagreed with you pounce on you more. It's not like they say, oh, at least you've learned. No, they say you show weakness, and then they pounce more. And so those are times in the public sphere where, you know, I hope I've told the truth. There's certainly a lot of times where I've shaded things because I'm afraid of the pain. But there are a few times I hope I've done that.
Well, you learn.
Yeah.
Each time. All right, let's go to... here in Washington, D.C., hi there, Roderick. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Brooks, I have been a fan for many years, and I appreciate the dialogue you have invited us to look into. My question really is about your thought on this notion of exceptionalism that seems to be sweeping across our public discourse and seemingly to justify a collective sense of being right and others around us and in the world as being something less or less worthy. Could you share some thoughts about that?
I do think that, say, in the realm of politics, if you see yourself as politics as a competition between partial truths, or see at a competition you could be wrong, the other side could be right, or at least you have something to learn from them, then you're going to approach the people who disagree with you with a sense of respect. But if you think you have the truth 100%, then the people who disagree with you are just in the way. And so I think that's a case where a sense of 100% I have the truth 100% leads to the polarized culture that we're part of. And I think it's very hard to be modest and be polarized because you think, well, A, I could be wrong. And B, the piece of the truth is something they have. A piece of the truth, hopefully, is something I have. And we both have a piece, but sometimes values are in tension.
But don't you think that phrase, American exceptionalism, sure, has somehow inflated the nation as a whole? I mean, and then gotten its way down to the individual.
It's very funny how that phrase evolved. And so Ronald Reagan had his phrase, shining city on a hill, by which I think he meant we're up there and everyone's admiring us and we're shining city on the hill. It was originally used centuries before to mean the whole world is watching us and we're falling down on the job. It was really meant in a 180-degree different way than it was used by Reagan. It's been used by politicians since. It was part of what they called a Jeremiad, that we're not living up to our standards. And so it was used in a very humble way originally, and then it was then twisted and became a proud phrase when it was used in the 20th
century. Way too proud, yeah. It seems to me. Yeah.
So, but the sense they had in the 17th century and then the 18th century was, you know, the experiment of democracy is important for the world. And if we don't do it well, we're letting down the whole world. And they had a sense we're not living up to those standards. And that was partly a political problem, partly a moral problem. They thought, as John Adams said, that the health of the country is ultimately dependent on the virtue of the citizenry.
How do you see it now being used, that phrase?
Now I think politicians see, you know, we're the greatest country on earth. And now that phrase is, look, we're shining, we're glowing.
Not good.
But, right.
So, but not good.
I think John Winthrop and those people back centuries ago said that the light is shining upon us and investigating us. But they had a different meaning of the word shining. It's not our light. It's God's light coming down, shining upon us and scrutinizing us.
Do you also think that that use of that phrase may engender a fair amount of dislike?
It could be from around the world. And certainly it was striking. I mentioned the command performance episode and the Ernie Pyle passage, and his passage was very much against that. We're not God's chosen people, and we should be worthy of the peace. And I think that was, you know, they were humbled by the use of the atomic bomb at that moment. They were humbled by the vast sweep of World War II and how big it was and how individual human beings didn't matter that much and some of the things they had to do to win, which were not always wonderful things.
Exactly. And you're listening to the Diane Reams show. Let's go to Greg in Burlington, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. David.
Hi.
I'm just painting my bathroom listening to this interesting conversation.
Multitasking, excellent.
I just want to say I'm echoing the gentleman who called before about the American exceptionalism, and I think there's a false bravado, not just with politicians, but very, very many Americans as well. And I'm living in the South for over 20 years now. I have experienced, especially within the last 5 or 6 years, some type of a religious exceptionalism. And I don't know if you want to comment about that, but it's uncomfortable sometimes. So thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one value that, say, the religions that are most common here, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have in common, it's a great appreciation for humility. It's a great appreciation for the humility before God, humility in our own sinfulness. And anybody who turns faith into a form of self-love is violating the whole gist of the whole thing.
David, the cover of your book is rather curious. sort of a, not quite a stick figure, but almost non-human.
Interesting. It's an icon of a figure like it's almost like the men and women's room. It's supposed to be unisex, so I confess to me it looks more male than female. But
it does with the broad shoulders, yeah, and the straightened arms, and then the two shadows,
yeah,
emerging from it. Why was that figure chosen?
Well, of course, my artistic abilities are ranged near zero, so I would defer to them. But I think the two figures refer to a central thesis I have in the book, borrowing from a rabbi, Joseph Soloveitchik, who said we have two sides to our nature, Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the external side who wants to build and create. Adam 2 is the internal side who wants to be good and represent truth and honor your creation. And he said we all have these two sides, and sometimes those two sides are in tension, and we live with the confrontation between our external drive to succeed and win victories and our internal drive to live for truth and discover the joy of a family meal. And it's those two tensions within us that really make some of the internal drama of our lives.
And we're sort of dealing with that all the way through both childhood and adulthood.
Right. And I think we emphasize Adam 1 more, but our Adam 2 sides, you can go sleepwalking through your Adam 2 lives. And it's necessary to awaken them and live in that life. And
is your
them.
Hope that through this book, people will form their own groups, begin to talk about these issues?
Yeah, I would love it if it was more interactive. I'm setting up a webpage now that's meant to be interactive where people can share stories. And I would love it if I really don't think you can read a book and that'll get you somewhere. But you got to make it a permanent part of life. And that means you talking about it, focusing on it, and doing it with friends. The great thing about character is that we stumble together and we have our arms around each other, and you do it by talking to each other with guidance from others, by friends that are living, and we all have them, and then friends who are dead. The 10 characters in this book are like my friends in some way, and I have conversations with them. I was at Monticello last weekend, and I went to Thomas Jefferson's home and looked on the wall there, and he had his friends. He had dead people that he admired, and he wanted to see their faces on the walls. And some of them were people from philosophers to scientists to political leaders, and he just wanted them in his lives as a sort of examples. I think it's a very useful thing to have dead people on your walls and to serve as guides and friends.
You know, I talk to my husband almost every day. David Brooks, and the book is titled The Road to Character. Lots to talk about. Thank you, David.
Thanks so much, Diane. Great to be here again.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.